Nevertheless, it sets the geography of communication for the province, and therefore it sets the commerce. The adjacent workable land, some of it of riverine origin, the scenic resources, some mineral resources, and the fishery are all of major resource value to this province. These resources are a direct consequence of the natural history of the river, and it's that history that I want to discuss. Because I'm going to touch on many topics, I'm going to make reference to work that's been done by many colleagues. No one person could possibly cover the range of things that I want to talk about this evening. I trust that my colleagues will not be offended by my appropriation of their results in order to incorporate them into the story that I have to tell. The picture that's on the screen at the moment is a picture of headwaters of the Fraser River at Mount Robson, about 1,370 kilometers from the sea, and the head of the river seemed like an appropriate place to open the lecture. The natural history of a major river is a long history. The history of Fraser River began more than 10 million years ago. Possibly it goes back as far as 30 million years, we don't really know. But the drainage basin didn't always have the form that it has today. If we examine the drainage network, we can see that the northern tributaries up here all flow, and the main river itself flowing here from Mount Robson up to Prince George, flows with a northerly set. North of the Chilcotin River, that's this major river flowing down through here, the land appears once to have drained to the Peace-Mackenzie system, probably via the valley now occupied by Crooked River running from Summit Lake down to the Parsnip River, which takes off from about there and runs north into the Peace River country. The history of the development of the modern drainage system is lost in time, but a number of events which have determined the character of the modern river may have helped to assemble the actual drainage basin. Within the last 10 million years, the contemporary coast mountains have risen. That's the consequence of tectonic processes on this leading edge of the North American continent. The tectonic regime is controlled by the relative motions of the oceanic and North American continental plates, by which ocean crust is being subducted beneath the edge of this continent. Uplift in the coast mountains over the last 10 million years has been up to 4 kilometers. That is about 0.5 millimeter per year, averaged over those 10 million years, though the uplift wasn't strictly constant, of course. About half of that uplift, actually, was due to the accompanying erosion as the rivers eroded downward in response to the increasing height of the land. That erosion removed earth material from the crust, which was responded then by being lifted as a result. And that, the erosion and the combination of tectonic and erosion-induced uplift has created the great contemporary relief. Some of the major rivers have, by this erosion, maintained their course across the coast mountains as the coast mountains have arisen, the Skeena, the Hamathko, and some others. Fraser River, in contrast, maintains a course along the east side of the coast mountains in fault-controlled valley and then runs around the southern end of the coast mountains to the sea. The southern part of the river appears to have held this course for many millions of years. Nonetheless, the coastal mountain building did have an important effect. It steepened the lower course of the river substantially. This is a fairly unusual feature amongst major rivers of the world. The increased erosive effectiveness of that steepened lower course may also have prompted headward erosion, particularly in this region up through here, which led perhaps to the capture of the northern drainage. We do not know for sure. However that may be, the steep lower course of the river has established one of its major contemporary features. It's an unusually fast flowing river all the way to the sea. In flood, mean velocities of 1.5 to 3 meters per second occur, even in the lower mainland, where the river slope slackens substantially. About 2 years ago, I was conducting a field trip along the lower part of the river with colleagues from the United States and Europe. We were standing on the riverbank at Agassiz. It was about mid-August. The summer flood was going down, but the river was still belting by. And somebody said to me, "How fast is this river flowing?" And when I said, "Well, the mean velocity is about 2 meters a second, and the surface velocity you're looking at is about 2.5, perhaps 3 meters a second," some of them wouldn't believe me, because they simply didn't believe that a river of this size could move at anything like that speed. And Mr. Donnelly did his swim. I hope he came downstream, because he would have thereby got a substantial assist from the river. It would have been hard swimming going the other way. Now, another important earth-building element of these far-off times of which I'm speaking was the occurrence of volcanism on the interior plateau of British Columbia, east of the mountains, and also in certain areas within the mountains. On the plateau, the volcanism took the form of generous outpourings of lava from various cones and fissures. And today, these lavas are widely evident in the Thompson and Cariboo Plateau and along the middle course of Fraser River. Here's a lava edge and talus that's resulted from the erosion of blocks from that lava edge. It's possible that lava flows interfered with the courses of the rivers when they were first being emplaced in the region, and that may have been sufficient as well to create realignments of the drainage that evidently occurred. With the rise of the mountains came glaciation. And glaciers have been a very major influence on the contemporary condition of Fraser River. Glaciers are known to have occurred within the mountains for about the last 3 million years, and they've extensively eroded the valleys along which the ice flowed out of the mountains. It's increasingly evident to us today that the erosion was remarkably selective and concentrated along the principal lines of ice flow, which were the pre-existing river valleys, and so the ice substantially excavated and enlarged those valleys in many places in the basin. It's also possible that glacial blockage or erosion of drainage lines gave form to the drainage patterns that we see today. So there's three possible means by which the contemporary drainage may have been assembled in the Fraser Basin. Most of the remaining evidence of glaciation pertains to the most recent one or two episodes, because evidence of earlier glaciations has been eroded by later events. The last major glaciation occurred between about 20,000 and 12,000 years ago, and it inundated all but the highest peaks and ridges of the province. This is what a view of the lower mainland may have looked like about 15,000 years ago, looking across to Mount Baker. So far as the contemporary river is concerned, it's mainly the consequences of deglaciation that should occupy our attention. This view was taken in Fraser Canyon just 12,500 years ago, last October. And it shows the remaining ice and a mass of sedimentary debris. There's ice in the valley back here and a pile of sedimentary debris in front, with meltwater from the ice moving that debris out and along the Fraser Canyon. There are two major consequences of this deglaciation that are of current interest to us. One is that the late glacial ice blocked certain drainage lines, ponding meltwater into lakes, some of them very large lakes. And these lakes drain by unusual routes. This is particularly true in the Fraser Basin, where the drainage is southward and westward toward the mountains. And of course, the last ice was present in the mountains and blocked the normal egress from the drainage basin. Some of these lakes were very large indeed, and some of them are shown in light blue on this map of the basin. The lake which I've called on here, the Thompson Okanagan Lake, down in the southeast corner here, which actually was a complex sequence of lakes with various assigned names, drained southward through the Okanagan system, for example, and into the Columbia. Drainage into the Columbia River system was extremely important because this established a connection to the unglaciated southern Columbia River basin, which was a principal ice age refugium for fauna. And so fauna was able to re-enter the Fraser Basin from the Columbia Basin at the end of the ice period of ice inundation in the Fraser. To the north, Glacial Lake Prince George, a very large lake, drained for a substantial period via that crooked river connection that I mentioned before, and thereby reestablished for a period the ancient connection to the north. Probably that connection was reoccupied many times during the Pleistocene ice ages. Whilst this slide is on, I'll also draw your attention to the dark blue lakes, which are scattered around the drainage basin in the headwaters along both the western mountain edge and the eastern mountain edge of the basin. These are lakes that were dammed not by glacial ice, but by glacial sediment deposits that have remained in place, or in some cases have developed in basins that were deeply eroded into the rock by glaciers, which at the edges of the mountains had maximum flow energy and maximum erosive power. Consequence is that there's this sequence of major lakes around the Fraser Basin today, which forms an important element of the hydrology and an important ecological element of the Fraser River system. The second major consequence of deglaciation was the accumulation of large volumes of glacially mobilized sediments along the major valleys. This paleochrome is an 8,000-year-old view of the Middle Fraser Canyon. The sediment pile is complex. Some of the sediments in the valley are direct glacial ice deposits. Some of the bottom deposits of former lakes. Some of it is river deposits, sediment washed off the hillsides after the ice went away. And some of it, indeed, is sediment that has been left over from before the glacial period. Since the exhaustion of the most easily remobilized hill slope materials and reestablishment of soil stabilizing forests and grasslands, which occurred not long after deglaciation, the supply of sediment to the river valleys has decreased greatly. So the river began to re-entrain the deposited material of the valley and thereby to cut an inner gorge within its Pleistocene sediments. The inner valley that you see here, and here is the valley fill, recording a long history of sedimentation along the Middle Fraser Valley. We're used to thinking of the sediment load of rivers as being derived from the land surface, but in Fraser River, and indeed in most rivers in British Columbia and in Canada, most of the sediment load today is derived from the banks of the rivers themselves. The sediment load of Fraser River today is a legacy of the glaciation. Other events along the river are the consequences of tectonic and glacial history as well. Lillooet and its immediate surroundings are constructed on a series of terraces formed by the river as it is eroded through its valley fill. So we have terraces at various levels in here, upon some of which the town of Lillooet is built, and upon others of which agricultural development has occurred. As usual, the valley fill here is complex. It includes lake silts. It includes glacial deposits. And on the terraces, a surficial cover of river deposits. But the lowest terraces in here are composed entirely of recent or relatively recent river deposits. Here at Texas Creek, about 14 or 15 kilometers to the south of Lillooet, on at least two occasions in the last 10,000 years, and most recently, 1,200 years ago, a major landslide occurred off the adjacent hillside into Fraser River and blocked the river. The consequence of the steep relief, undercutting by the river, and the presence of partly glacial materials and partly bedrock materials sliding off the steep slope into the river. The landslide blocked the river, disrupted salmon migrations in the river, and was the evident reason for the abandonment of villages in the region at that time. I have no doubt that similar events have occurred elsewhere along the river in other times and places. And we certainly know that events of this sort have occurred elsewhere in the mountain rivers of British Columbia because they're recorded in the histories of some of the people who lived along those rivers. The contemporary hydrology of the river is also a consequence of the history of the basin. Because of the great relief in the basin, with substantial portions of it at elevations above 1,000 meters, both in the mountains and in the interior plateau, and with the margins of the basin defined by major north-south running mountain ranges, which lie across the dominant winter storm tracks, the basin gains a very heavy snow load, which is what makes skiers of us all. The melt and runoff of the snow load in spring and early summer is the major hydrological event in the river. Here is a characteristic hydrograph. It's the 1972 hydrograph recorded at Agassiz, just in the lower mainland. The red plot is the flow. The green plot is the plot of sediment concentration in the river. The peak of the freshet reliably occurs, as I expect most of you know, within a week or two of the 1st of June. And with the water comes the annual sediment load. The peak of concentration actually leads the peak in flow because the material is picked up mainly along the margins of the river on the steeply rising part of the freshet after preparation for transport by the preceding season's frost. With a total annual sediment transport of some 18.5 million tons in the lower part of the river, the total load of Fraser River is small in comparison with that of other major rivers of the world. The sediment load here is emphasized by comparison with the clear, because drained from a major lake, Thompson River. The suspended sediment concentrations in the river average about 500 parts per million in freshet, and peak concentrations are on the order of 1,000 parts per million or so. And this is rather modest. So the sediment load of Fraser River is rather small. Compare the Mackenzie River, of which the annual load is about 100 million tons, for example. Nonetheless, this sediment load is very important in the story of Fraser River. Now to this point, I've described to you a river which, as a consequence of its history, has the following characteristics. It has an unusually steep and rapidly flowing lower course. There's a sequence of major lakes near the headwaters which modulate the seasonal hydrology and form an important aquatic habitat. There's a largely undeveloped landscape which delivers waters of high quality to the river. And there's a major and reliable annual freshet dominated by cold meltwaters from high-altitude snowpacks. There's a modest but consistent sediment load which provides moderate turbidity. These conditions are ideal for salmonid fish, which are in general fishes of fast, cold waters. Indeed, these fishes have evolved, I suspect, with the development of the physical conditions of the basin. Fossils of the ancestral Eosalmo are found in the tertiary deposits of Fraser Basin, and so the fishes have been here and around the glaciated North Pacific Rim in most of the other steep mountain rivers throughout this last 10 million year history that I've described, evolving as the landscape has evolved. They're used to the fast, cold water. They're strong swimmers. They're able to move in steep rivers. They have good jumping capability. They spawn and rear in the gravels that occupy the bottoms of these rivers. They take advantage of the moderate turbidity to hide from predators during their migratory runs, whilst at the same time, the moderate nature of the turbidity does not appreciably interfere most of the time with their own feeding and foraging. The reliability of the annual freshet and of the sediment load means that their return runs to spawn and their downward runs to the sea are relatively reliably carried by the flows of the river. Fraser River is the greatest producer of salmonines in the world. The occurrence of Pacific salmon in the river in recent years has averaged about 14 million fish, and the yield from the river, the catch, all classes of catch considered, has been about 12 million fish. That's below the greatest catches that occurred shortly after the turn of this century, but they are still remarkable catches. Much of the human history along the river has been tied up with those fish. Today, a rapidly increasing population in the basin is beginning to create resource use conflicts, both within the exploitation of the fishery and in competition for various other uses of the river. These conflicts are most serious in the heavily populated lower mainland. And so I want to focus some attention here in the second part of my talk. I'll emphasize aspects that arise from the natural history I've just described. In the lower mainland, the river approaches the sea. As the gradient lessens and the current slackens, the larger materials in the sediment load are deposited along the lower course of the river. The lower mainland, the course of the river can be divided into three parts. From the eastern end of the lower mainland to just above Mission, the river flows over gravel deposits. That is the part of the river where it loses the load of the largest materials that the river has carried from the canyon and that have come from the adjacent montane tributaries. Between Mission and New Westminster, the river flows in a single sandbed channel. And from New Westminster to the sea, the river flows through its delta. In the lower canyon, the river flows rapidly between rock walls. Most of the sediment load is washed through, and there are only limited seasonal deposits and restricted areas of bars along the edge of the river. But after the turn at Hope, the river is no longer so confined, and here it begins to deposit a load of gravel and cobbles in the channel, which creates a distinctive riverscape of islands and bars, the deposits, around which the river flows. This creates a pattern of channels which includes a very extensive length of shoreline because of the multiple shorelines across most cross-sections of the river, including the shorelines around the islands. Side channels with reduced velocities behind these islands. And a wide range of water depths that all flows. The bars submerged in this midsummer view slope gradually in toward the main Tallweg or the main course of the river away from the islands and shores. And so as the stage of the river varies through the annual cycle, there's always a reasonable distribution of shallow waters, waters of intermediate depth, and deep waters. This morphology, which is repeated on smaller scale in many other coast mountain rivers and in rivers around the glaciated North Pacific Rim, constitutes ideal salmon habitat. The reach between Hope and Mission, particularly between Laidlaw and Mission, is the most important pink salmon spawning area on the Fraser River. The view is of pink salmon red diggings. Red is a salmon egg nest. That's near the mouth of Harrison River. This is probably the most important single pink salmon spawning reach in the world then. This is an important rearing reach for the Harrison run of Chinook salmon. It's an important habitat for chum salmon and steelhead as well. The importance of this reach of the river derives from the morphological complexity of it, from that mixture of main and side channels, islands and bars, and extensive shoreline. The complexity derives from the pattern of movement and deposition of the gravel in the river. The gravel constitutes the larger material in the bed of the river. Consequently, it moves by bouncing, rolling, and sliding over the bed of the river. And where the flows diverge and the current slackens, the gravels may come to a stop and begin to build a bar. Once deposits begin, the flow diverges more around it, and so subsequent gravel moving down the river will move into the same position and be deposited. The bar is slowly built up by the accretion of successive sheets of gravel over many years, each sheet being only one or two grain layers in thickness. What that does is divert the waters and force the waters against an adjacent bank, and the attack of the waters there, where the flow comes back together, reconverges, prompts erosion along that bank. And so material is picked up from that bank and moved farther downstream, where it's deposited in another bar. Sometimes the attack is on an island or an older, more mature bar. Sometimes it's on the outer banks of the river. In any case, the sediment, this large materials, the gravels that are only carried forward at high flows, are slowly staged along the river by being eroded, moving a few hundred to a few thousand meters, and being deposited again and being replaced in the active load by compensating material that is eroded from adjacent banks. The pattern of bars then, some of which grow up into islands when they get quite large, then sand begins to deposit on the surface, vegetation becomes established. The slack waters in the vegetation then permits rapid accumulation of sand and the buildup of the island to floodplain level, the establishment of a forest, which may persist for several hundred years until the island itself comes under attack and disappears back into the river. These things then constitute the complexity that makes this such ideal fish habitat. On a river the size of Fraser River, the patterns of erosion, transfer, and deposition of sediment are persistent for years at a time. This is a vertical air photo of a part of the river. That's the mouth of the Harrison River, so it's just west of Agassiz. Here's the town of Chilliwack. And this picture was taken in the late 1960s. At that time, substantial sediments being eroded just near Agassiz were moving through this channel and being deposited in this reach that eventually forced the main current of the river in the late 60s, early 70s over here against this mountain side, where it then was deflected straight across here to attack the shoreline here. And through the 1970s and late 1970s and most of the 1980s, heavy attack here consumed a substantial portion of farmland and threatened a farmstead. The major point of attack has slowly moved downstream and in recent years has threatened a major hydroline crossing here to the point where the crossing was finally removed. And the sediment eroded from here in compensation for the deposition in this area has moved around the corner and has been deposited in this area and down to the Harrison River mouth, where there's been substantial aggradation in recent years. That whole pattern has persisted for about a decade now. And so it's possible to some degree to foresee and to predict the patterns of erosion and transfer and deposition, though our ability is far from perfect and certainly is not quantitative yet in that regard. This process has gone on for 10,000 years. And so today there's a huge accumulated volume of gravel in this reach of the river. But the amount of gravel delivered annually to this reach is only about 200,000 tons, which is a paltry amount of material. And the amount declines downstream as material is abandoned by the river. So that we have about 200,000 tons passing Agassiz, but by the mouth of the Harrison River, we only have about 60 to 80,000 tons in transit. And much of that is lost near Sumas Mountain in the reach downstream from the Harrison River mouth. The persistent abandonment of this lode over a period of many years leads to the building up of the riverbed. This cartoon illustrates how the river, particularly now that it's constrained within dikes that have been built in the last century, as material is deposited, raises the level of the bed and therefore raises the stage of the river, the level of the flow, or the level of the water surface for a given flow. And that, of course, threatens to make flooding problems worse than they formerly were. If we consider the total amount of gravel coming into this reach of the river and distribute it over the entire length of this gravel reach, the aggradation, the rising of the riverbed, amounts to a few millimeters a year. But the deposition tends for periods of decades at a time to be concentrated in certain reaches. And in those reaches, for several decades at a time, the aggradation may approach a centimeter or so a year. And after a few decades, the total rise begins to become somewhat worrying. With rapidly increasing settlement and commercial development in the eastern lower mainland, there is today substantial pressure to permit removal of major volumes of gravel from the riverbed for the commercial aggregate industry. It's argued that this will reduce the flood danger as well by lowering the riverbed again. But this will also effectively interrupt that pattern of downstream movement of gravel that builds bars and islands and subsequently destroys them and moves material on, all the while turning over the gravels and maintaining the character of the habitat, which is so favorable for the fish. Consequently, it seems to me we must proceed very, very carefully if we're going to entertain the removal of gravel from the riverbed. Paradoxically, although there is a huge accumulated volume of gravel in this reach, the maintenance of the current river processes, critical for the maintenance of the fish habitat, appears to depend on the mechanics of transfer of that very modest annual increment of the gravel stock. And that's why the issue requires intensive study. It's interesting to me that the gravel load of the river is only 1% of the total sediment load. It seems ironic that it is such an important feature of the river, in that the river morphology appears to depend on it. But it's the gravel that forms the bed and the lower banks of the river, and so it's the movement of the gravel that produces the morphology, and in particular, the morphological complexity. That's the way of rivers. They hold many surprises of that kind. Farther down near Sumas Mountain, the gravel bars disappear from the river. The river is run out of gravel. From here to the sea, it flows in a single sand bed channel. Past Mission, 18.5 million tons per year on average of fine sediment moves toward the sea. About 50% of it is silt. About 15% of it is clay. That's a remarkably small proportion for a major river of clay. And that, again, is a glacial legacy. There's relatively little clay-sized material in the sediments of the Fraser River system. And about half is silt, I said. And about 35% of the material is sand. Half of that, 17% of the material that passes Mission, would ordinarily be deposited within the channel and on the estuarine sand flats before the river reaches the Strait of Georgia. The view, incidentally, was in winter 1983. It obviously wasn't in winter 1997-8. It's largely that sand load that has led to the growth and development of the Fraser Delta. Here's a series of maps produced by my colleague, Dr. John Clagg of the Geological Survey of Canada and his co-investigators, which shows the growth of Fraser Delta. Here we are out here on Point Grey, and there's the Fraser Delta about 9,000 years ago at New Westminster. By 5,000 years ago, it had spread out over
part of South Surrey and Delta, and finally, in comparison, the picture today. Just think, if you'd been around 5,000 years ago and lived at Point Roberts, you'd have been living in the Gulf Islands. About 3,000 years ago, the value of your property would have taken a steep dive. That's when contact was made. One of the interesting things about the Fraser Delta is that the growth rate in terms of volume added appears to have been relatively constant. And that tells me that the erosion rate upstream of the glacial sediments and their transfer toward the delta has been approximately constant over time. And that in turn permits the inference that the river ecosystem has been able to develop and adapt to an apparently broadly stable physical environment during the last several thousand years. And I think that's probably an important observation for understanding its character today. The delta channels, the so-called estuary of the river, and from the viewpoint of a geomorphologist or river hydrologist, that's a misnomer, the delta channels constitute the most highly developed part of Fraser River. Here, adjacent to Vancouver, riverside industries and settlements have a significant, though still moderate, effect on water quality. We're properly concerned about water quality in the lower Fraser River, but I can say it's still remarkably good in comparison with water quality in most major and heavily settled rivers of the world. As in many other things, we still have the last best chance on this coast to preserve some of the original ecosystems functioning in something like their original fashion. But the requirements for channel control, to keep it in the same place, and requirements for ship navigation have led to the installation of extensive river guidance structures as well over the last century. Sand which moves through this reach of the river on the bed of the river during the freshet forms large sand dunes. They can be up to 4 meters in height, though more usually they're 2 meters or so, and more than 100 meters in length, though again more usually 40 or 50 meters in length. The progress of them can be tracked by repeat echo soundings. I and some of my students made these echo soundings several years ago when we went out on the main arm every day with our little 18-foot boat and drove along a precisely navigated track line in order that we could measure these sand dunes and check their movements from day to day. That's what these alignments are intended to show. Sounds like a fairly foolhardy thing to do, sort of going out there on the river in an 18-foot boat. I mean, we've got these 30,000-ton ships coming up the river, sort of bringing 2,000 Hondas at a time, and you'd think it's kind of dangerous to be around those things. It was kind of an interesting experience. Those things are so well designed, they're so streamlined, and the providers you can see them coming, and they're big, you can see them coming. Their wake is no problem whatsoever. They throw up hardly any wake. But a 30-foot fish boat, that threatens to swamp you every time. And the one time we really actually were nearly swamped was when the RCMP boat went tearing by us 10 feet away, charging off up the river as fast as they could go. I guess someone was stealing some water somewhere. That left us thinking. Nonetheless, we obviously survived. I'm here this evening. The dunes threaten to interfere with navigation on the main channel, which has been dredged to ensure 10 meters clearance for vessels. And because these dunes form up every spring and march down the channel, additional dredging is required every year to maintain navigation, both in the dune fields and in places where sand characteristically settles in quieter water. Two problems ensue from this. The first of which is to decide what the dredging requirements will be to maintain the channel. And this isn't a simple matter. Ideally, you have to forecast the dredging requirements before the sand gets there. That's because bureaucracies have to set budgets in advance. So someone comes along to me and says, right, how much sand is going to come down the Fraser River next summer? Well, I haven't any idea yet.
There's a rough correlation between flows and sediment transport, but it's also apparent that sediment is staged and moved through the lower river according to the sequence of annual floods in a fairly complex way. The instructions for this talk said it shouldn't get too technical, but so here's my technical bit. This is a plot of the suspended sediment passage down the river. It's actually a plot of the difference in suspended sediment transport between Agassiz and Mission. And the difference in suspended sediment transport between Agassiz and Mission is the amount that goes into storage in the river or comes out of storage in the intervening distance, in the gravel reach. Most of what goes into storage or comes out of it is the sand portion of the load. The silt and the clay stay in suspension and whistle right through. What we can see is that in a year with a normal flood, 1968 had a flood that was almost exactly equal to the mean annual flood. There's a sort of a, this is Agassiz minus Mission. So there's initially an accumulation in that reach on the rising side of the freshet, and then later on most of that goes away again. But by the end of the season, there's a modest net accumulation of sand in that reach. That happens in most years. But in a year with a big flood, 1972 is the second biggest measured flood on record, there's a big net loss. So it turns out that sand is stored in this gravel reach and then periodically sort of pulsed out into the lowermost parts of the channel in order to get in the way of shipping and all the other things that go on in the lowermost part of the channel. That raises an important additional issue related to the business of would-be gravel quarrying from the channel in the gravel reach. It's quite possible that that may destabilize this pattern of sand storage and onward movement. And so changes upriver may become additional problems downriver. We really haven't worked out, because we haven't yet sufficiently analyzed this problem, to know. But this illustrates an important principle of understanding what the river does before one sets out to do major activities or make major changes along the river. The second problem that's associated with the dredging in the lower part of the river is the question of the delivery of sand to the delta front and to the tide flats, which are themselves an important habitat. How might changes in the amount of sand that reaches the end of the river influence the development of the delta and the maintenance of these tidal flats? We do know that in recent years only a fraction, 30-40% of the historic sand load has been getting to the end of the river channel. And we do know that in some places along the delta front, there's been retrogression of the front of the tide flats by tens of meters to hundreds of meters in recent years. Not in all places along the front, but in some. And an additional problem is the degree to which increasing structures along the front of the delta interfere with the lateral distribution of the sand. In the long run, this ecologically important area may be influenced by the changes that we're imposing in the sediment budget in ways that we don't yet see or understand. The hydrological regime and the sediment supply in the modern river are consequences of the natural history of the Fraser drainage basin, particularly the history of elevation of the basin and the history of glaciation. The hydrology and sediment supply through the river today are ideally suited to the maintenance of an aquatic ecosystem dominated by salmonid fishes. These features are also, particularly the sediment supply and movement, are also sensitive to disturbance by human activity along the river. Sedimentary materials are stuff that subsists in the background of our day-to-day lives. I suspect most of you haven't thought about sediments very much recently. I suspect most of you didn't expect to think very much about sediments when you came to this talk. No one pays them much attention, except the odd nut like me. As minerals, sand and gravel is not valuable. That, incidentally, is part of the problem. Sand and gravel must be quarried close to the point of use because of its relatively low value. But sand and gravel are an immensely important part of the material of human settlements, and they're a critical part of the architecture of the river. With increasing settlement in the region, probably to continue for a long time, again, this is one of the last best places on the planet, and people are attracted to it in large numbers, there's inevitably going to be changes along the river. I don't think we can avoid that in the long run. I think, therefore, it's vital for us to continue to study and improve our knowledge of the river and of its natural history in order that we should come to understand and anticipate the nature of the changes that are going to occur. It's absolutely essential that we do this if we're going to sustain those features of the river which we value. And our current knowledge of this river is not sufficient for us to be assuredly able to sustain the features of the river which we value. I hope that's something you can go away and think about this evening. I thank you very much for your attention, and I hope the talk's been interesting. Lights. That didn't help much. Well, it gives me a blackboard to write on. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions for Professor Church? Yes.
Professor Clark.
I would like to ask you, the creation of a new regional transportation authority, will that have any responsibilities and influence?
Professor Clark asks that with the establishment of a new regional transportation authority, will that have any influence on the directions and in the concerns which I've pointed out this evening? I'm afraid I cannot answer the question because I do not at this stage understand the full authority and intentions of this new regional transport of urban and suburban and exurban development. And if a rational plan can be put in place with by a real authority with regional powers, it seems to me it should be perfectly within the realm of possibility to plan directions of development in order to focus on areas where development is best placed, to avoid areas where development is less well placed. Whether persons in that authority will be sensitive to or have the information or knowledge to understand and take proper account of needs for development in certain places and avoidance of development in others along the river, I can't say. I can say that I'm sure it will be a hotly contested issue.
Care to comment on the prospects for and effects of another flood?
Would I care to comment on the prospects for and the effects of another flood? I assume you mean an extraordinary flood. Last year, most of you will recall, there was some concern along the lower river. The flow was the third highest fully gauged flow along the river. Probably fifth or sixth highest amongst the flows of which we have some knowledge at all. The floods along the Fraser River, as I pointed out, are reliable in their occurrence. We can predict them, at least in the short run, tolerably well because they result from the melt of the spring snowpack, and we know late in the winter what the size of that spring snowpack is. How high the flows are going to get depends on the sequence of spring weather and also whether we obtain heavy rain at the same time as the main snowpack is coming off. A flood that is substantially larger than the 1997 flood could occur, but it would occur relatively rarely. We do know that in recent years, as a result of
regional developments in climate, the run of floods has been below the long-term average. That's because winter snowpacks have been below the long-term average of winter snowpacks. And so last winter was a relatively exceptional winter in recent years. But a period that ended in the late 1970s and began with the 1948 flood, actually, the biggest one gauged, it was a period of unusually high floods. And so another flood of this sort, or a number of them, if we have another flip in the weather climate regime, could easily occur. After the 1948 flood, a substantial system of dikes was put in place along the lower part of the river. In the 1970s, that system of dikes was considerably upgraded and improved. And so there's substantially better flood protection along the lower river now than there was in past times when floods did substantial damage. I think, nonetheless, that there remains a marginal possibility that we may have a seriously damaging flood in the future. There's no absolutes in the game of protection against a major natural event on a river this large. There are, as a matter of fact, three places in Canada where I think there's a marginal chance of an event happening that could be very serious indeed. And the Lower Fraser, particularly the suburbs of Vancouver, is one of them. The Red River at Winnipeg is another, and we know how close that one came last summer to getting away. And the Back River at Montreal, where the Ottawa and the St. Lawrence come together, is the third place where there's really major urban settlement and infrastructure in close juxtaposition to a big river. At Montreal, the problem is ice jam-related flooding.
Yes,
yes, in the back there.
Yep.
There's a minor effect of water temperature on sediment transport, and that is because the viscosity of water changes with temperature, and that influences the efficiency of the suspension of the finer portion of the load. Was that a satisfactory answer? The question was that about 20 years ago, the habitat inventory section of the Department of Fisheries and Oceans built an inventory database for the Lower Fraser River, consisting, I guess, of information of occurrence of various fishes, benthic organisms, and water quality characteristics and other things. And the question was, does that inventory still exists and is it being used? And the answer is yes, it certainly still exists. And it's been used in a major way recently because a new set of detailed information on water quality and on contaminant burden of various organisms was taken in the early 1990s. The trends are various, but mostly they show improvement. That is, things are better than they were in the early 1970s on balance, although that's not true of all indicators and all contaminants. The question is, could I comment on what's been happening to sturgeon habitat? I don't believe there have been any important or definitive changes in sturgeon habitat in recent time along the lower river. There have been some important apparent trends in the population of white sturgeon, though it's very difficult, I understand, from fisheries people to know exactly what is happening. The sturgeon are difficult to study. The sturgeons like the deep holes in the river, and those deep holes were another consequence of that complex morphological pattern in the gravel bed reach. Where the river comes against the banks, deep scour holes develop. And the sturgeon that are found in the lower river are found in and around those deep holes. A decision to remove a substantial volume of gravel from the river
which may very well have the effect of essentially freezing the river in a current channel, and certainly the desire of some landowners and some people to mitigate and prevent bank attack, for obvious reasons of stopping land loss, could also reduce the number of deep holes in the lower part of the river. And so a decision to manage the gravel bed reach of the river for a variety of purposes, including gravel removal, erosion protection, flood protection, so on, could indeed have a bad effect on the sturgeon habitat. That's something else that we have to understand better, I think, before we charge ahead with it.
Final question here.
Is it true that Vancouver is built on an ancient glacial moraine associated with the Fraser Valley?
Is it true that Vancouver is built on an ancient glacial moraine associated with the Fraser Valley? There are morainic materials in the substrate of Vancouver, but as a straightforward proposition, the answer would be no. That is simply a much too simplistic description of the quite complex geology of Vancouver. We know that, amongst other things, there are bedrock outcrops within the city of Vancouver. The former quarry at Little Mountain is an example of that. The bedrock around Stanley Park is an example of that. And we find a complex sequence of glacial related sediments on top of that, and of course the non-glacial sediments of the river along the Fraser immediately to the south. So it's a much more complex picture than the simple statement suggests.
Thank you. And now I'm going to call on Professor Cole Harris of the Department of Geography of the University of British Columbia to be the speaker.
Do you need this thing? Okay.
Well, it's my pleasure to say a few words about my colleague tonight. As you've probably realized from the clarity of tonight's talk and from its informed detail, Mike Church is an awfully good natural scientist. A great many people think he's the best fluvial geomorphologist in the world. But he perhaps is, but but the point I want to make, it's the quality of Mike Church is obvious. The point I want to make is that he is an outstanding scientist who has thrown a very large part of his effort towards understanding the place in which he is. He's often said that the University of British Columbia does not have the luxury of being a Harvard of the North, by which he means that the university has a responsibility to the larger society in which it sits, to its place, to its environment. I know no faculty member at UBC who has made a larger contribution to British Columbia in a great variety of ways than has Mike Church. The other point I'd make is that Mike, by and large, works on his own. This is not big science. This is a really top-notch mind, thinking its thoughts, gathering its data, engaging in its field research. It's a type of science that I think is increasingly threatened. It's threatened by big science on the one hand. It's threatened by the relative penury of the university and by the increasing bureaucratic and pedagogic load that we all face. I guess what I really want to say is that I think the Mike Churches of this world are really at the very heart of what the University of British Columbia is. They're the essential reason why this place is as important as it is. And so, Mike, I want to thank you not only for a fascinating talk, but also for the way in which you do your science. I think you've got it right. I think the contribution you're making to the university and to this society is simply huge. So thank you very much on behalf of us all.